worse than at least how I'm feeling right now. But you should have in front of you lesson 183, the pre-1611 evidence for the text, the general meaning of the notes of John Boyce, part 5. Okay, so we've been at this now, looking at Boyce's notes. This will be the fifth lesson. And I was originally going to make this the last lesson on Boyce's notes, but then there was some stuff that I encountered that I just felt was too good not to talk about as it relates to the subject matter. And so I kind of inserted some of the stuff at the last minute. I also have some things I want to read out of a book by Leland Rankin probably towards the end that I don't necessarily have in the notes, okay? So, lesson 183, pre-1611 evidence for the text, the general meaning and the notes of John Boyce. So, introduction. In lesson 182, that would have been last week, we considered the interplay between Boyce's notes, the general meaning, and the English readings found in the King James or the Authorized Version. Put another way, we considered what Boyce's notes had to say about the discussions that transpired around the English reading of the text, or how the text should read in English, okay? We discussed the literary and auditory culture that characterized the English Renaissance of the late Elizabethan and early Jacobean periods in which the King James translators were reared. From John Selwyn's 17th century chronicle, we observed that the final step in the making of the King James Bible was an audible read. It was at this juncture that the translators amended the text based upon the, quote, Elizabethan aesthetic and how it would sound when it was read audibly. So we talked about the culture they were reared in. We talked about the English Renaissance and the impact that that would have had on these men. And we therefore then looked at how were they making last-minute adjustments to the text with an ear towards how it would sound when it was read out loud or read in English. Okay. In his note on Hebrews 13:8, John Boyce records Andrew Downs offering an alternative reading that, quote, will be more majestic, end quote. Therefore, we concluded that the goals of the translators were as follows. Okay, the primary goal, number one, is obviously translational accuracy or accuracy in the translation of the text. And second consideration would have been majestic English. So they are not primary. The majestic English is sort of falling secondarily or is subordinate to the idea of the text accurately stating in English what it is communicating in the underlying or original languages. We observed statements from the pens of David Teams and Alistair McGrath that implied that writing majestic English was accomplished by accident by the King James translators. While we understand their point, i.e. that writing quality English was a subordinate, was a subordinate concern to accuracy in translation, the notes of Boyce indicate that the translators were also concerned with the quality and register of the English text they were producing. So we kind of took a little bit of an exception there last week. Particularly Mike brought this up at the very end last Sunday that, you know, he didn't necessarily agree with David Teams and Alistair McGrath that they were not intentionally trying to create a majestic text in English. So I'm just trying to capture that thinking there with that point. Before moving off that topic, circle that, doesn't sound right to me. Before moving off this topic, that topic, I would like to look at some of the comments made by Gerald Hammond in the making of the English Bible, especially as they relate to the interaction of Boyce's notes with the final English text of the Authorized Version. So that brings us then to the first point. So does anybody have anything else that they want to bring up by way of review from last week and some of the points that we discussed? So I think Mike made a good point at the end that, you know, maybe McGrath is not necessarily stating that quite right, especially when we have clear quotes in Boyce's notes from Andrew Downs offering a reading from the vantage point that it would sound more majestic if we stated it like this. And we see that clearly on Alan, page 87. So then let's go on and look at like what's going to be the major point today. The making of the English text by Gerald Hammond. The following are some quotations from Hammond that I found too good to pass up, but did not fit neatly into the overall structure of the lessons as I laid them out. So sometimes when I'm researching and laying things out like, okay, I think we need to cover these topics in this order, there's like good stuff that's sort of laying on the side that doesn't necessarily fit into the nicely or neatly into the overall flow of what it is that I'm trying to accomplish. But we're only making one pass through Boyce's notes, and I just sort of decided that we needed to, I wanted to touch on this because I think he Hammond offers some interesting perspectives on this in addition to what we saw last week that I think are worth our consideration here. So what I did is I just sort of collected that up and decided to put it into this lesson here that we're going to cover today. So that kind of is just a brief explanation of where this came from, what I'm doing today. So let's look at the first quote. The first quote from Hammond is from page 181. And again, this is from The Making of the English Bible. He says, quote, "The committee was not impervious to individual brilliance. Ward Allen shows how the completely new word amazement was introduced into the Authorized Version's rendering of 1 Peter 3:6 at Andrew Downs' suggestion. The text reads, quote, whose daughters ye are, as long as ye do well, and are not afraid with any amazement. As Allen notes, the translator's difficulty was to find a word better suited than the earlier version's, quote, terror or perturbation to relate to any of the three possible objects of the verb, unbelieving husbands, the women themselves, or female ornaments. Downs' suggestion solved it ingeniously." So that reading, so if you grab your Bible, and find that verse. Find 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 6. Find 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 6. I just want you to understand what he's getting at there. And while you find that, I'm going to call up something here on the internet, assuming everything works the way it should. So we're looking at 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 6 here in this example. So let me call that up here on a Bible research program that I use quite frequently. So let me stop talking and type this in. 1 Peter, what are we at? 3, 6, right?
Yeah.
First Peter 3, 6. So we'll load that up, and we want to start looking first at the bishops. Okay, so let's read this in the King James first. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 6. And even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are, as long as ye do well, and are not afraid with any amazement. So what he's talking about there is that reading, that last word there of the verse, amazement, was a suggestion of Andrew Downs that is recorded in Boyce's notes at the final review. Now this is what the base text said. Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham and called him Lord, whose daughters ye are, as long as ye do well, watch, and are not afraid for any terror. So they changed terror to what?
Amazement.
So if you look in the note there, this quote from Hammond on page 181, then you also have the example there of perturbation. So let's look at the Geneva. The Geneva also has terror at the end of the verse. The Reims says, not fearing any disturbance. Let's look at Tyndall. Tyndall says, are not afraid of every shadow. So there's a lot of variation in the English text as far as how that should read, okay? And so what Hammond is noting is that there's a note here where in Boyce's notes where Andrew Downs suggests the word amazement, and they go with that word, and it ends up in the text. And it's creating an interesting reading that seems to satisfy all of the necessary considerations that one would want when thinking about how to translate that verse. Does everybody understand what he's saying here? Okay, so you see how that's kind of an interesting tidbit, but it didn't really fit nice and neat into other things that we were talking about. So go to page 2. Here is the second quote from Hammond. This is from page 183 to 184. He says, quote, we should note Downs's one other great contribution to the work of the revising committee, because it will lead us to a more general analysis of the translator's practice. This was his readiness to explicate, that means explain, New Testament Greek by way of Old Testament Hebrew. Now that's an interesting statement. What he's saying there is Downs's suggestions fairly frequently. Remember, we saw Downs is mentioned more than anybody else, like 98 times in Boyce's notes, that Downs's recommendations or statements are often, he's trying to explain the Greek by using the Hebrew. This is what Hammond is observing here, okay? Continuing with the quote, there is a simple but telling example in the note on 1 Corinthians 9:8. The Geneva Bible has rendered the verse like this: Say I these things according to man, saith not the same law also. So let's look at this. What verse is this?
1 Corinthians.
All right, 1 Corinthians. And we're talking 9:8, right?
Right.
1 Corinthians 9:8. Search. And we're looking at Geneva here in this, right? So here we have the Geneva reading. Say I these things according to man, saith not the law the same also. Okay? So go back to the notes. This is Paul capping a series of verses begun in verse 3 where he announces his defense to those who, quote, examine his apostleship. As a summary of the defense, the Geneva's rendering of the verse, one which the Reims agrees with, means that Paul is making a general comment on human affairs, one which the law supports. But the Authorized Version's translation is subtly different. Quote, say I these things as a man, or saith not the law the same also? There is more antithesis, I said that right? There is more antithesis between the speech of men and the words of the law here, and equally important, as a man, relates to the way Paul has been talking, not what he has been referring to. We can see that the genesis of the Authorized Version's rendering, if we look at Boyce's note, which says, quote, after the manner of men, Berechben, Adam, that's a person, A.D., or Andrew Downs. The English phrase is obviously Andrew Downs's rendering, one which the Authorized Version waters down a little, and Bedrich Adam is his justification for it. The Hebrew equivalent to the Greek word used here, an idiom whose translation would be after the manner of men. So if we look at this in the King James, where's the King James button? I think this one's it. Is that right? That doesn't look right to me. Where are we at? 1 Corinthians 9:8?
Yes.
1 Corinthians 9:8. Say I these things as a man, okay? Or saith not the law the same also? So yeah, this is the right rendering for the King James. Now, what his point is that Andrew Downs' suggested solving of the problem is coming from a guy who commented on this in Hebrew. Okay? So if you look at the notes there, the English phrase is obviously Downs' suggested reading, one which the Authorized Version waters down a little bit. So he said, after the manner of men, they have, I say these things as a what? Man. Okay, so the English phrase is obviously Downs' suggested reading, one which the Authorized Version waters down a little bit, and Bedrich ben Adam is his justification for it. The Hebrew equivalent to the Greek used here, an idiom whose translation would be after the manner of men. Why this note is so typical of the notes as a whole is because although it might conceivably have doctrinal implications, it is firmly based on the translator's sense of language and style. The most striking things about Boyce's notes is the almost complete absence of theological comment. From beginning to end, they are based on usage and context, grammar and etymology. This may, of course, be misleading. The original panels, so that would have been the companies, okay, the original panels probably did argue long and hard over difficult doctrinal points, and the revising committee might have felt bound by their conclusions. Equally, Boyce might have felt that his notes, which posterity would see, should reflect the translator's doctrinal unanimity. Still, what we have stands as a monument to men whose interests were principally grammatical and stylistic. So again, does this speak to the point that they are trying to put it together in a way that it reads well from a grammatical, stylistic way? So they're not necessarily at the final review, at least not according to the notes that Boyce has that have survived, debating theology of reading. They're debating more content, they're debating more grammar, style, and how things should read in English and context more so than anything else. Any questions there? So the second or the third quote then is from page 187 from Hammond. He says here, quote, a fair number of the notes relate to syntactic matters. Syntax. There is, for example, a lengthy and complicated discussion of Galatians 2:6, which concerns the translator's difficulties in coping with the phenomenon found in both New Testament Greek and Old Testament Hebrew, and that is the failure of the writer to complete what he is saying. The Greek begins like this, from but the ones seem to be something. This is followed by a long parenthesis, and unexpectedly, no apparent attempt to complete the statement which had begun the verse. So let's go look at that verse. That's Galatians 2:6. So you can see what he's talking about. Okay, so notice this verse. So here's the King James reading. But of these who seem to be somewhat, that's correct, right? That's the way you guys have it? Yeah. Then you have a parenthesis. Whatever they were, it maketh no matter to me. God accepteth no man's person. Is that the same?
Yep.
In parenthesis, for they who seem to be somewhat in conference added nothing to me. So if you go back to the note now, what he's talking about is you have this, you have a statement interrupted by parentheses without a seeming completing thought, okay? So this is followed by a long parenthesis and unexpectedly no apparent attempt to complete the statement which had begun the verse. The Geneva translators assumed an ellipsis here, and they rendered the opening of the verse like this, and of them which seemed to be great, I was not taught. So let's look at that. Let's go to Geneva. So here you can see what he's talking about. But of them which seemed to be great, I was not taught. And then you have the parenthesis. Okay? So you notice as the Geneva insert this phrase, I was not taught, that if you go back to the King James, you will see is not in the verse. But of those who seem to be what?
Somewhat,
comma, parentheses. Alright? Back to the notes. But Andrew Downs disagreed with this, and argued rather than an ellipsis, what the verse failed to do was to provide an apodice. It's a fancy word for conclusion, okay? The length of the parenthesis leads the speaker to make a new beginning. The effect of the Authorized Version's rendering, which follows this explanation, is to bring a verse closer to the sense of a man thinking and speaking. And then here you have the verse. But of those, so we're on the top of page 3. But of those who seem to be somewhat, whatsoever they were, maketh no matter to me, God accepteth no man's person. So the parentheses is like, you know how in the cartoons they have like the little, you know how they have like the hard line to the bubble of what somebody's saying versus the bubble with the three things, what they're thinking? So what they're showing here is the interplay between what Paul's saying and what he's thinking in the parentheses. So read it that way and see what you think. But of these who seem to be somewhat, That's his statement. Whatsoever they were, it maketh no matter to me. God accepteth no man's person. For they who seemed to be somewhat in conference added nothing to me. You see how that is capturing the interchange between what Paul's saying and what he was what? Thinking. Okay? So I just think that Hammond has a lot of these very sort of interesting observations of Boyce's notes that I could not find anywhere else, but didn't necessarily fit nicely in any of the other notes that we were talking about the about when it comes to this. Next quote is from page 188, where he says, quote, "The most revealing thing about the notes is the testimony they bear to the respect with the which the translators bore for the whole English Bible tradition, in particular for the Geneva Bible. There are several notes of detailed discussion of complex verses where in the end, the existing English rendering is accepted almost unchanged." And we've seen that already before, right? And I'll remind you of something which I think Hammond didn't maybe totally get understand here in a few minutes. But we do know that in the places where the Bishop's Bible was altered, the base text of the Bishop's Bible was altered, the text that most often provided the alternative reading was the Geneva what? The Geneva text. Okay? Then I have a long quote here because it's got a lot of interesting examples in it that actually, if you go all the way to page, top page 5, you'll see runs from page 189 in Hammond all the way through page 191 in Hammond. So in my notes, I start quoting it on page 3. It runs for the rest of page 3. So if you're following along with me online, I'm on page 3 at this note point right here, finally Boyce. Okay? So this is a longer one. And let's make sure we understand what's going on here. Finally, Boyce's most common type of note is the shortest, but often the most revealing if I have interpreted them right. So he does have a caveat there if he's interpreted them right. So this could be subject to different view, but I think Hammond's is interesting for us to at least think about. Okay. Unlike the rest of his comments, they are entirely in English. And it seems safe to guess that they represented renderings which the committee had considered, but which they ultimately rejected. If we consider examples from just one book of the New Testament, they will give an idea of the range of inferences which can be drawn. This is a selection from the first 16 chapters of Revelation. So he samples Revelation as a way of looking at what could be gleaned from the rest of it. Obviously, there's too much here for him to write on all that he could write about, and we've already addressed that problem in a previous previous set of notes. So, look at the first one. The first one, here's Boyce's notes. I'll try to make this as big as I can for the benefit of those who are watching, okay? So, Boyce's note on Revelation 1:7. With the clouds or in the clouds. That's all it says. But the AV rendering is, behold, he cometh with clouds. Behold, he cometh with clouds. Boyce records discussion around with the clouds or in the clouds. But here we have coming with what?
With clouds.
With clouds. Okay? So let's look at the discussion underneath this. Separating the definite article, or by suppressing the definite article and thereby choosing Geneva rather than Reims, the alternatives of the note are both included. That the clouds are a manifestation of God's coming and a shrouding of his presence. So look at these, look at it. With the clouds, in the clouds. They solve it by saying just simply, with what? So you see how that reading is really brilliant because it is indicative of the fact that the clouds signal his coming, but are the clouds also to some degree, to put it the way he says it, shrouding his presence? You see what he's getting at here, okay? Let's look at the note on 2:3. Boyce's note. Hang on. Here we go. The note. And thou hast borne a burden, or thou hast borne a burden. Thou hast borne burden, parenthesis a burden, or thou hast borne a burden, the AB rendering. And thou hast borne and hast patience, and for my name's sake hast labored. So let's look at what he says about this. Earlier versions have overcome the difficulty by rendering the transitive verb here, the transitive verb, which here has no object. Reams had made, quote, for my name, its indirect object, quote, and has borne for my name, Geneva, was used an intransitive English verb, and thou hast suffered. Boyce's notes suggest two ways of smoothing over the harshness, either signaling the omission by interpolating the object, or going further and assuming that the Greek verb legitimately meant bear a burden. But the authorized version chooses neither and stands as the most abrupt and most literal of the English versions. So it's the most literal, which is not necessarily shocking given other things that we've seen. The note on Revelation 6:6, the note says, for a tester, AD. So who's recommending that reading? Andrew Downs, but the AB reads for a penny here. The Greek is denarius. Downs's tester is not so literal. D, as the abbreviation for the old penny, came from denarius, but it represents Jacobin values better. So what that means is, did it represent the value or the weight of money better at the time period of the translation? Okay. A tester was equivalent to sixpence. The committee chose a rendering which went back to Tyndale, thereby ignoring any attempt to give the verse a contemporary relevance. So they're not test. So in other words, if they would have picked tester, would that have been maybe more accurate for how much money was worth at the time they were translating? Yeah, but they elected not to do that and just to go with what?
Penny.
You following that? So now we're on Revelation 7:15. Boyce's notes read, he shall pitch his tent over them, he shall protect them, he shall dwell with them, he shall rest upon them, shall rule over them. The AV reads, and Sylvia, we need to add, did you take out rendering here? Or did I not add it?
It wasn't in the book.
You're right. All the other ones had. So when I originally typed the notes, I added rendering to some of these just to keep it consistent, but the book didn't originally have it.
That's what happens when we have the book.
But I don't. I think there's probably typos in the book. I don't. It doesn't make sense to me that they would have it one way for half and then switch. It's probably just something they didn't catch, but...
You want me to put them back?
No, we'll just leave it the way the book has it, okay? So go to Revelation 7:15. Revelation 7:15. Now watch. Here's Boyce's note. Okay? Here's what the text says in this verse. Therefore are they before the throne of God, and serve him day and night in his temple, and he that sitteth on the throne shall dwell among them. Right? So we're talking about this phrase right here, and he that sitteth on the throne shall dwell among them. Notice all the language there that is in Boyce's notes. What Hammond says about this, under the quote at the top of page 4, Boyce's first suggestion is probably the most literal. The note typifies the range of possible renderings which the committee considered. So in other words, that they consider all of these as potential ways of translating. Okay? That's what Hammond's saying. The note testifies to the range of possible renderings which the committee considered. In the end, they chose the least figurative and the one which went back by way of Geneva to Tyndale. So again, you can see the interchange there between the previous English versions. Okay, let's look at Revelation 10:9. The note of voice says, "And it shall offend thy belly," versus what's the AV reading, "And it shall make thy belly bitter." Okay? The opposite to the previous note. The committee considered a more abstract rendering, but they reject it because they need bitter to contrast with what follows, and to make thy belly bitter, but it shall be in thy mouth sweet as honey. So go look at this verse. Go with me to Revelation 10:9. Revelation 10:9. Notice how they're doing this here, okay? Revelation 10:9 reads in the King James, "And I went unto the angel, and the angel gave unto him, give me the little book, and he said unto me, take it and eat it up, and it shall make thy belly bitter." So in other words, is it going to upset his stomach, to put it, just to paraphrase it, okay? "It shall make thy belly bitter, but it shall be in thy mouth sweet as what? Honey." So imagine if the verse read, "And it shall offend thy belly." But by making it read this way, are they having a direct contrast between the bitter and the what? The sweet, right? So you see what he means here. So, again, reading from the notes, the committee considered a more abstract rendering, but they reject it because they need bitter to contrast with what follows, "And it shall make thy belly bitter, but it shall be in thy mouth sweet as honey." So you have the direct contrast there between bitter and what? Sweet, versus if it had read, "And it shall offend thy belly." Well, in other words, is it saying the same thing, that it would upset the stomach, but it, by saying it the way they say it, do they make the contrast extremely, it's extremely clear what's going on, the way they end up making it read in the AV. Look at the next one.
"See, now, I would flip-flop that, and that would sound better to me." You see what I'm saying?
To say, "It shall offend thy belly"?
"It shall offend my belly." No, it shall, no, put the, it is sweet as honey, but it will make my belly bitter. That's how I would have read it. See what I'm saying?
So you would flip, you're saying if you were saying it in modern English, you would flip the clauses.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the reason the clauses are in the order they're in is because that's the order they're in the original Greek.
Great. Okay.
So when they're translating it, they're following the order of what it has in Greek, and they're trying to then pick the best way to state in English what it says in Greek. So instead of saying "it shall offend thy belly," they pick and they say "and it shall make thy belly bitter."
Yeah.
And you also have a little bit of alliteration there too, you know, bitter belly. Anyway. Revelation 11:17 is the next one. Boyce has in his notes, "And has entered thy kingdom." The AV says, "Saying, we give thanks, O Lord God Almighty, which art and wast and art to come, because thou hast taken to thee great power and hast reigned." Okay? The note expresses some uncertainty about the temporal emphasis of the last phrase. Either the perfect tense is dangerous because it implies a completed action, or the translators feel that the context requires a parallel to the preceding clause, i.e., another expression of taking power. Geneva had translated it, quote, "and has obtained thy kingdom," but the bare past tense, as in the Reims rendering, is the one the revisers chose. Like many of these examples, it indicates a confidence in a literal translation rather than an explicatory one. So, we're talking about this last. Has entered into thy kingdom versus has what? Reigned. Okay? So, do you see? Some of this stuff might be lost on us, honestly. But are they really getting into the nitty-gritty of the tenses and what is the best way to state it? Not only for, primarily for accuracy, but then secondarily for English readability and so forth. Then we have Revelation 14:8, the note of the venomous wine recommended by Andrew Downs. The reading, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Downs's, that should be an apostrophe.
Yeah.
Downs's interpretation of the Greek word is probably the more accurate. John is describing a poisonous liquid, but the committee prefers to allow the earlier English versions in the more expressive mingling of wine, anger, and fornication, and they choose to retain the Hebraic of the structure rather than one that uses two adjectives. Now, this structure right here, of the, is basically the way a lot of things are said in Hebrew, okay? So, you're familiar with expressions like King of Kings, Lord of Lords. You have the of in the middle. Now, in modern English, you might say the greatest king or something like that, right? But the expression Lord of Lords or King of Kings, the reason it reads that way in your English King James Bible is because they're following the Hebraic structure. So because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, they're keeping a cadence there to how they want it to read. Down says of the venomous wine. Well, there's a multitude of ideas that are wrapped up in what's going on here that are captured in the expression of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. You following that? Okay. And then we have 16:19. Revelation 16:19. Or, so that he gave her, is Boyce's note, in the AV, and great Babylon came in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup. Page 5. Boyce's note is followed by the subhost, i.e., a Greek subordinating conjunction, so that. But the revisers prefer the more Hebraic infinitive, as had the Geneva and the Reims. So, why I like Hammond and why I decided to include this is Hammond kind of really gets into the nitty-gritty of some of what the notes tell us about what they were thinking, when we can compare what Boyce had in the notes and what ends up as the final reading in the AV. Okay? And then go to page 5, next quote from page 192. In introducing these notes, I regretted that they did not fulfill Pollard's prediction. So Pollard is a reference to Alfred W. Pollard, who we'll see in a minute. Did not fulfill Pollard's prediction that they might lead us to see the successive stages of translation. And then I have a bracket here. Hammond is referring to the following statement from Alfred W. Pollard. Quote, if the notes which Dr. Boyce treasured so carefully to the end of his life had been preserved, it might be possible to trace, if only for a single section, the work done at the different stages of the revision. That's from Pollard, page 60. That was too bleak, Hammond says now, for with a little guesswork it is possible to trace some of the stages of discussion which went into the making of the authorized version. So Hammond went into it thinking that if he observed and went through the notes of Boyce, that he would, they would prove out what Pollard had said in his 1911 book, but he's kind of admitting that that's not necessarily the case, okay? So then underneath this, I have an indented sort of commentary on this that we need to look at. While I do not disagree completely with Hammond's observation in this last citation, we must remind our readers that Hammond was operating with a misconception regarding the importance of Rule 1. Earlier in the making of the English Bible, Hammond stated, quote, "The authorized version translator's problem was quite straightforward. Their brief was not to make a new translation, but as far as possible to base their work on the existing English text. And for this, James, the piper calling the tune, was the bishop's Bible. Hence came the first rule laid down in the list of those, quote, to be observed in the translation of the Bible, Rule 1, the ordinary Bible read in the church, commonly called the bishop's Bible, to be followed and as little altered as the truth of the original will permit." Notice what Hammond says, though. But the pressure for a new translation had been an essentially Puritan one, led at the conference by John Reynolds, in the belief that the existing versions were corrupt and not answering to the truth of the original. Both in answer to this call and for their own scholarly abilities, the authorized version translators knew that the bishop's Bible was the most corrupt and that the Geneva Bible and the Geneva Bible the least, and if they were to use a copy text making a good one better, then this good one would have to be the Geneva Bible. That is not true. That is not true. Hammond's assumption there is not correct. Okay? We have proven through Manuscript 98, and we have proven also through Bod 1602, that the 1602 bishops was the base text that they were amending or revising that ultimately became the King James Bible. So I'm not reading from the notes right now for those of you that are looking for what I'm saying. When they alter the bishop's text, the most often used English translation to provide the alternative reading from the bishops was the Geneva, but Hammond is not right about this point. Okay? Further down the list of notes, at number 14, there was an order whose strict interpretation would inevitably result in a Bible closer to the Geneva than any other. Then you got Rule 14. These translations to be used when they agree better with the text than the bishop's Bible, Tyndale's, Matthew's, Coverdale's, Whitechurch's, Geneva. In essence, this rule, and not the first, was the one the translators followed, and the Geneva Bible, not the bishop's Bible, became the foundation of the authorized version. That's not true. Okay, now, top page 6. Hammond appears not to have perceived how the other work in progress primary sources, Manuscript 98 and Bod 1602, when used along with Boyce's notes, work in concert with one another to offer a more complete picture of the various stages of the work. While this is a weakness in Hammond's analysis, his observations are nonetheless exceedingly valuable. Okay, now does anybody have any comments about that? Now, in 2011, this is not in your notes. In 2011, there were a bunch of Bible conferences that were happening around the country related to the 400th anniversary of the King James. I have been asked and been given a variety of different assignments as it related to those conferences. And in doing so, I picked up a bunch of books. I showed you one of them last week, which was David Thames's book, Majesty, the King Behind the King James Bible. Another book I picked up at that point is this book right here, The Legacy of the King James Bible, celebrating 400 years of the most influential English translation by Leland Rankin. Now, I don't have this in the notes, but I want to read to you from page 157 because it relates to what we're talking about here as far as English. He says, page 156, quote, "A single comparison will need to suffice as an illustration. The King James rendering or rendition of 1 Timothy 6:6 is, he says, oral.
I can't even pronounce this word, so I'll spell it. O-R-A-C-U-L-A-R. Oracle?
Oracular?
It's oral. It's what it means. Here's the rendering. But godliness with contentment is great gain. Here is an aphorism that not only expresses an insight, it compels it. Here is how three modern translations manage to drain the verse of its power. First one. Well, religion does not make a person very rich if he is satisfied with what he has. So remember, what's the statement? But godliness with contentment is great gain. So here's a modern English translation that says, again, well, religion does not make a person very rich if he is satisfied with what he has. Fail. Not very good. Next one. But godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. Next one. And of course, religion does yield high dividends, but only to those who are content with what they have. And then here's what he says. Someone has correctly said that modern colloquial translations, quote, slip more smoothly into the modern ear. But they also slide out more easily. The very strangeness and antique ceremony of the older forms makes them linger in the mind. So what's he saying? If you want your Bible to sound like a newspaper, it'll come in and out and you'll forget it. But if you, the older forms of the King James speech linger in the mind longer and than the three alternatives that we just read. Okay? Now, at the conclusion of the afterword, Rankin says a few more interesting things. I have quite a bit highlighted here, but I'll just read to you a bit of it. He's lamenting the loss of the King James. He says on page 230, he says, quote, first, we have lost a common English Bible in both the church and culture at large. It is an incalculable loss. On numerous fronts, life was greatly simplified when virtually everyone agreed on what was meant by the Bible. Conversely, many things became problematic when the agreement ceased and some things were permanently lost. See below. Second, the authority of the Bible went into eclipse when we lost a common Bible. Probably this was inevitable, but we do not need to explore the logic of that line of thought here. It is a fact that the English Bible is no longer accepted as an authoritative book in the public spheres. And I have explored it in this book, Religion, Education, Law, Politics, and the Arts. Even when modern literary authors refer to the Bible, they usually do so in a manner that challenges the intended meaning of the biblical authors. Third, biblical illiteracy has accompanied the decline of the King James Bible. This is widely acknowledged. When a colleague in my own department learned, this guy's an English professor at Wheaton College, when a colleague in my own department learned that I was writing a book on the King James Bible and its legacy, she volunteered the observation that after King James's Bible gave way to a proliferation of modern translations, even Christian students became inept at seeing biblical references in literature. Recently, the media were abuzz with a volley of shot by Andrew Morton, poet something of England, about contemporary students' inability to detect biblical allusions in literary courses. Motion said in a BBC interview that today's students know so little of the Bible that when he recently taught Milton's Paradise Lost, it was very difficult to even get beyond, go into talking about it. In other words, All of these modern versions they all are sold to us on the basis of it makes the Bible more understandable. But it's actually had the exact opposite effect, and Leland Rankin, a professor at Wheaton College, is pointing this out in his book. He goes on to say, claims by modern translators and Bible scholars that the Christian public is fortunate to have been delivered from the archaisms and occasional inaccuracies of the King James, don't think I necessarily agree with that, turn out to be hollow. If Bible knowledge in our day has declined across the board, where is the alleged gain from modern translations? The very proliferation of translations has discouraged the Christian public from seeking to know what the Bible actually says. The ideal, of course, would be for a single successor to the King James to be its replacement, but this did not happen. The sentiment is widely held that because today we find the King James Bible archaic and difficult, it must have been equally archaic and difficult to readers in previous eras. It is a great fallacy. Readers of the King James through the centuries did not struggle with its language, just as modern readers who never relinquished the King James managed just fine with it. Are we better off today without the King James than Christendom was for three centuries with it? No. Those eras have more advantages over us. Although we cannot turn back the clock, we should lament what has been lost, not claim an illusory superiority. What has been lost? A common English Bible, a nearly universal reverence for the Bible as an authoritative book, and biblical literacy. Finally, we have lost the effective and literary power of the King James Bible. Not in an absolute sense, inasmuch as the RSV, New King James, and ESV do a wonderful job of approximating the qualities of the King James and updated English vocabulary, but the approximation is not duplication. Of course, dynamic, equivalent, and colloquial translations do not come close to the King James standard, and modern readers of those translations have no reason to gloat. They have exchanged a birthright of excellence for something manifestly inferior. So those of you who are watching this, I would encourage possibly our brother Mark Ward to pick that up and read that, because he's taking, Leland Rankin is, a very different approach to what Mark Ward is arguing for in Authorized. Page 6, conclusion. Chapter 4 of Dr. Norton's 2011 publication, The King James Bible, A Short History from Tyndale to Today, is titled, quote, Working on the King James Bible. So that's the title of Chapter 4. In this chapter, Dr. Norton has a subsection titled, quote, Manuscript Work and Notes, in which he surveys the three primary work in progress documents, Manuscript 98, Bod 1602, and Boyce's Notes, that we have been studying in this class. At the very end of chapter 4, Dr. Norton stated the following, quote, looking back over the evidence for the making of the King James, I think it good luck of having as much as we do outweighs the regret that we do not have more. We know much more about the King James Bible than any previous version, and it is worthwhile reflecting that Shakespeare scholars would be delighted to have even a single autographed manuscript of one of his pages, or a printed text that he himself had supervised. That so much survives is partly testimony to the grandeur of the scheme initiated by King James, involving so many people, some of considerable fame outside of their participation in the translation. It was always likely to leave more historical traces than any other version. Moreover, in spite of the modesty exhibited by many of the men who were, after all, merely revising many good previous versions, the occasional sense of pride epitomized in Samuel Ward's declaration, quote, I was a translator, shows that there was some sense that this was a special work. This sense contributed to the survival of the treasures such as Boyce's Notes. So, anybody got any questions or comments? So, next Sunday, we will not have this class because we are having our Bible conference. and we have a conference session during this time. The following Sunday, the last Sunday of October, Blake is going to teach. So the first Sunday of November, we will resume this, and I'm going to teach the last lesson on voice. And then from there, we're moving on into the actual 1611 itself, the actual King James text and the 1611 Bible itself, and we're going to talk about things related to that when we're done with voices notes in a few weeks. Anybody got any questions? All right, appreciate your attention, and we'll see you in a few weeks back here. We'll be for the